I remember my boss had a saying of, you know, high performance sport is about the relentless pursuit of being better at everything every day, right? So whether that's your administrative processes, or it's how you do something, or how you communicate something, or how you present something. And so that was a starting kind of real light bulb for me of like, oh yeah, this is really about pushing the envelope every day.
Today's episode is with Gareth Sanford, who specializes in helping coaches maximize elite athletes' speed and endurance. He has been working across different Olympic, para, and pro sports for over 13 years. He also holds a PhD in sport physiology and running performance. Gareth believes that evidence-based findings are valuable, but they can sometimes act as anchors that hold back innovative ideas. You'll hear about this philosophy and much more during our conversation. Enjoy.
Gareth Sanford, welcome to 80-20 Endurance, the podcast that's 80% glycolytic phosphorylation. I've messed it up. I should have rehearsed. We're going to take it from the top. It's actually, if you're going to mess up, do it at the top. Gareth Sanford, welcome to 80-20 Endurance, the podcast that's 80% glycolytic phosphorylation.
Maybe Gareth should intro himself.
Yeah. I'll give you one more try. Phosphorylation. I got it. Gareth Sanford, welcome to 80-20 Endurance, the podcast that's 80% glycolytic phosphorylation and 20% you lost me at glycolytic. Welcome.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Hannah. Good to be here.
I'm very excited to geek out on exercise science with you. That is your specialization, though you're also an athlete, or you have a background as an athlete. You understand coaching. So we'll get into all of that. To kick it off, I understand you've been doing a lot of travel lately. It's part of the reason we didn't get to interview you a week or two ago. So where have you been going and why?
Yes. Yeah, so for the last 4 years, I've been working with the Athletics Canada Federation. And so that involves traveling to training camps, competitions. So most recently Flagstaff in Arizona, which you know well, Matt, and then competitions, world champs in Eugene last year, Tokyo and Sapporo Olympics before that.
Nice.
And before that, you also had quite a big world tour. Is that right? Working with multiple different teams, and now you're just with the Canadian triathlon team. Is that right?
It's changed a lot. Yeah. So in 2015, I moved out to New Zealand from the UK, which is where I'm from. And as part of my work in New Zealand, I was doing a PhD, and for 6.5 months traveled to different squads across 8 different countries, 33 different training groups. And that was to understand the challenges coaches are facing in this middle distance space where you have high levels of speed and high levels of endurance, and how coaches are tackling that. And then from the more like endurance end of this kind of thinking about how do we improve the kick and managing surges in a race, which is becoming an increasing part of being successful. And so that started in New Zealand. And then, yeah, part of that was time in Canada. And I moved to Canada end of 2018. And I now do consulting around the world with not just, I guess, Olympic-based sports, but also professional teams in that intersection where speed meets endurance.
Yeah, and we'll get more into that a little bit later. But I will say, you know, probably you wouldn't be a guest on the podcast if the roles you just described were all you did. But you also do some public-facing stuff. This is how I discovered you. It was just really on Twitter. You provide a lot of education to athletes, coaches like me. I'm always looking for new sources, you know, credible sources of information who aren't just duplicating sources I already know and have. So I'm like, all right, I'm holding on to this guy. And I've learned a lot. You've carved out kind of a unique angle for yourself. And it rounds out my continuing education. Can you describe that a little bit? Like, you know, why, you know, you offer education to a lay audience of coaches and athletes, and what your approach is?
Yeah, I think it's really tough for people in this world of abundant information to kind of figure out the wheat from the chaff and like what should we really be thinking about. And often in you pick any domain, you often get one side or the other side of an argument, and that makes it really challenging for athletes at the back end. So an example would be, you know, most people I encounter, because of either their experiences or their training, their, let's say, coaching approach is often very strongly in one camp or another, meaning either very endurance focused or very speed focused. And that's fine as a starting point, but the reality of the matter becomes that most training squads have athletes that have qualities across that continuum. So if you happen to be someone with more endurance type physiology, you know, very slow twitch muscle, good aerobic capacity, and you fit an endurance type coach, that's great. That works out for you. But if you're someone who has a blend of both, or someone who's very speed dominant, then actually you're running into a situation where you're just not getting what you need. And this happens left and right across sports. This is not a one sport issue. And, you know, I'm very lucky to work with a lot of great athletes. And you see in athletes, they give their lives to do this sport and they get one chance. And so to me, there's a real accountability on us, who are the people who are supporting these athletes, to give them the best shot at maximizing what they have. And I don't know that any of us would be that comfortable if it was like, well, it didn't work out because we didn't get the model right. You know, and so yeah. When I started thinking about this problem in New Zealand, you know, New Zealand has population of 4.5 million, so size of Phoenix, Arizona, right? If they find one athlete, they have to get it right because they might not have another talent like that for 15, 20 years. And so my whole way of thinking about this problem is, rather than starting with, hey, here's my model, whatever it is, it could be at either end of the spectrum or whatever it is. Instead, let's start with, well, who do we have in front of us? What do they possess? How do we really understand that? And then with that in mind, then think about how we progress someone from there. And I'm not saying you get 100%, but I think rather than maybe 60 to 90% of your squad not getting what they need, we substantially increase that batting average.
Yep.
That's a good way to describe your approach. And that's kind of what I learned about when I was doing some research about you too. You know, you're very definitive on how you approach things. I heard you say in a podcast, if you just have evidence you're following something that's interesting, it's not necessarily something that matters. And I think that kind of relates to how you share your information as well. Like Matt said, you know, you can make one tweet that's 180 characters, whatever the tweet allows, but you can spew something out that will get a lot of clickbait and will be a conversation starter. But it seems like you have it down to providing real information that's beneficial and not just clickbait.
Well, hopefully, I think to Matt's original question, I think what I try and do is present both sides of this thing, you know, and one of the, I guess, fortunate positions I've developed is that I understand both sides, right? I've been a sprints coach and I've dealt with physiology for more than 10 years now with endurance, triathletes, cyclists, runners, marathoners. And so whichever end of the kind of training paradigm you come from, yeah, we can talk about that. But the reality of the matter is, if you want to play the game at the top level, then, hey, the best people have elements of both. The balance isn't the same for everybody, but they're considering both ends all the time. And I think there's a responsibility for us as people, as stewards of athletes' careers, to give them exposure to everything, to maximize what they have.
I have a follow-up question, if that's okay,
Matt.
Matt has definitely done more research in this area than I am. So this is coming from more of the athlete side.
Yeah.
And I was a swimmer my whole life and I swam middle distance. So a lot of your research was very interesting to me. But as a child growing up in the same sport, I was kind of just shoved into that distance because that's just kind of what I was good at. Honestly, middle distance, people complain about it, you know, like it's the one that no one ever really wants to do. So I would do it, blah, blah, blah. And my question is, is there a way for an everyday athlete to kind of test what they're better at? Yeah. Is it more endurance or more sprinting? Is it just going out and doing a race and seeing how you place?
Yeah, good question.
How do you figure that out?
So there's two things I'd say. Like there's a couple of tests that I use as a first layer. One is a sprint. So if you're running 50 meters, if you're on the bike, a 10-second sprint and take the max 3-second peak power. And then a 6-minute run or 6-minute effort on the bike, and that will get you approximately your speed at VO2 max. Now, that's a first layer. That's not the whole font. There's other things I look at too, but for anyone in the middle of nowhere who doesn't have, you know, if you just have a stopwatch and some cones, like you can capture these things. So I'd start with that. That gives you these two measures of the sprinting speed and the max aerobic speed. And you have big differences between people, right, in their reserve. And that gives us an indication of, okay, what is this person starting with? Then we can get into, okay, well, to what degree have we trained all the elements that underpin those two things, right? Another easy thing to do is, what are the three training sessions you like the most or enjoy the most? And what are the three you really don't enjoy, right? And you map those on, and they get pretty close. So I'm sure everyone listening, whatever their situation is, you can achieve those things. And I think if you think back to school, what were we rewarded for? Class, teacher asked a question, what were we rewarded for?
Right answer.
The right answer. Mm-hmm. And one of the big problems I see in training across the board is these models, like I have an endurance model or I have a speed model, is like, we've already decided the answer. We've already decided the answer. And how athletes adapt is so variable. It's so variable. And so actually we do the test and people go, okay, well, now what? It's like, now you go on a journey of exploring and understanding who you are as an individual. And every day when you're doing training, you're getting feedback on how that presents, right? Whether it's a long run, whether it's a tempo run, whether it's something faster, you're getting feedback on how, okay, we think you're here based off the profiling. On day one, you can achieve that. But every day you're then refining that over time. And very quickly you're like, oh, okay, now we're really steering into who you are as an individual. So it can sound a lot, but I think we have to change the frame on actually how educationally we've been taught. Of, we don't have all the answers. You know, I'm very lucky to deal with people who are, you know, in the top 15, 20 in the world trying to get to that Olympic podium. There is not a playbook on how to optimize them. The only question is about, who are you? What do you bring to the table? And how do we maximize and leverage that? Because that's what's going to express itself when it comes to the battle. So question-led approach to training and being okay with that, I mean, is I think a big piece here, because the models are will get you so far, but they're comfortable and you already have the answer. And it's like, okay, well, that's going to give us a batting average that is not as good as it could be.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I like that you say that. Sorry, I'm taking over the podcast. This one's a comment. It's not a question. Then you can ask. But I was just going to say, I like that you include, what are the three workouts that you enjoy the most? Because it is ultimately about enjoyment. We're not, you know, the majority of the listeners listening to this podcast are not trying to get to the Olympics.
Yeah.
So, and that's what you're going to be training the most. So it is also that enjoyment piece. But yeah. I was just wondering if, you know, you get slotted in, and then, like you said, you have a playbook for endurance and sprint, and then that's who you are, and then that's the workouts you do. And
yeah, maybe to tilt that as well, this is not saying that if you're, let's say, a more speed dominant athlete that you don't do endurance. It's right. Saying that based on understanding who you are, that you're more of a speed type person, we're going to train your endurance through that lens, as opposed to going, hey, endurance people, when they train endurance, they do X. You're also going to do X, even though you present totally different. So that's a really important point, just to clarify.
Yes. Actually, if I had been given an opportunity to ask my next question, you would have had an opportunity to make exactly that point. Because, you know, if the discussion doesn't go any further, you know, my fear would be the athlete's takeaway is, oh, I just indulge my strengths.
Right.
I mean, this is definitely an area where I can learn a lot from you as a coach. But I remember writing a blog post some years ago about, you know, the tendency to sort of like overdo the concept of training your genes. Mm-hmm. Like my approach as a coach is like, you're training for events. Like the events have the same demands, you know, for everyone. Well, I mean, a marathon's a different thing for a 210 marathoner and a 420 marathoner, but you know what I mean? Like, you know, just because like you do a bunch of physiological testing and it shows you're really good at powerlifting, that doesn't mean you train for a marathon with powerlifting exclusively, right? You know, yeah. So how do you meet in the middle where you're sort of like, you're individualizing based on how the athlete presents, but you also are, you know, respecting the universal demands of the specific event?
Yeah, you raise an important point, and the athlete profiling really is the first part. Then I want to understand the sport demand. So again, there's going to be I call it like a sigmoidal curve of performance, right? What determines like success in a competition that's trying to achieve a 4-hour marathon is very different to what it means to run a sub 2-hour marathon, right? There's a sliding scale of what becomes important to differentiate those groups. And so you first of all want to have clarity on your goal and go, what am I trying to do? Because then we can ask that exact question. Okay, if your goal was 4 hours in the marathon, what does that look like, right? There's training demands, there's fueling demands, there's pacing demands, there's all those different elements. When we get up to, let's say, sub 3-hour marathon, we're talking about a different time duration here, a different intensity, different things that are going to separate those who can do that versus those who can't. And so there's a interlocking here of these four components. The first component, who are you? What is your profile? Number two, what is your goal? What are you trying to do here? Right. Number three, relative to your goal, what are the demands of that? Go as deep as you are comfortable with. And then underneath that is, okay, now we need a training plan. Right. Now we need a coach's plan that's going to put all that together with all of those things in mind. So that's how I put those things together. And again, we're very quick to go, oh, let's skip to the answer. We should do this. Oh, you want to run a marathon? You should do this. And it's like, well, that's fine. But if, you know, if we're again about maximizing the opportunity for people to achieve their goals, you really want to go through that process.
Yep. Hannah,
so back to you. Usually we have a really good cadence. Today we might be off a little bit, but
we've had a gap. You know, we haven't done an interview in like 4 weeks, and we're clearly rested.
Yeah, we've had a nice little summer holiday break here. So going off of that, then, what is your opinion on ready-made training plans?
Yeah, what is my opinion? Well, it's going to be as good as the person doing it, right? As appropriate as the plan is to who's doing it. So that's kind of the dance. And also like where somebody is, you know, on that path, like we talked about, not everyone's trying to be Olympic champion. So that's fine. You know, probably for, let's say, the first 3-ish years of doing a program, you're going to see improvements from something that's maybe a bit more generic. And the reason for that is that you probably have a lot of limiting factors across a lot of different areas. And actually, your limiting thing is you just need to do the work, right? But if we're now talking about you trying to get to a much more, let's say, elite level, then we have to think about the problem differently, because, you know, where you were 3 years ago is not where you are today. You're at a different place in the river, right? And so we encounter this all the time, where you've got someone who's been in a training program now 5-6 years with the same coach. And we have to ask the question, okay, well, what are we going to do differently to move the needle? Because you've now adapted to what that is. So I think, yeah, there's starting points for everybody. And if you're at day zero, then doing some work is just what you need to do, and do that consistently.
Yeah. I see it like kind of there are four, it's a hierarchy of four steps. If you're going from winging it to a one size fits all plan, you're stepping up, like you are going to benefit, but only but you're not going to optimize. And then if you go from following a cookie cutter plan to a customized plan, you're going to make further progress, assuming the plan is appropriately customized. But again, that is still not going to take you to full optimization. To get fully optimized, I think you would say is you need like sort of like an adaptive experimental learning type of plan where it's like, okay, let's try some stuff.
Yeah.
Let's learn from what we try and then steer according to based on what we learn.
Yeah, maybe a tilt I'd make on it as well is that one of the things, particularly in the endurance world, people don't get exposed to is the speed side of things. And I just want to double click on that a second because, you know, one of the things that I was collecting when I did that around the world tour was sprinting speed on distance runners everywhere, right? Everything from 800 through to, I think I had some 10K marathon people in there. It was primarily middle distance, but there were some people up there. Is that often you start distance running because at school you had this day where you got exposed to like, hey, we're going to sprint today, and you realize you weren't that good at it, right? And so you took the endurance route. You know, you're familiar with that kind of feeling or observe that in people. It's like, okay, so then what happens is you go down this road of, hey, we're now in a training model of you're an endurance person, so we're going to do volume. And then the skill set of developing speed was never part of your learning as an athlete. And so we rarely think of running as a skill. But when we think about sprinting speed, so we're talking again about that 50 meters all out, a 5-6 second max effort, that's primarily limited by technique and the force that you can put in the ground. Mm-hmm. And generally speaking, coach education is on energy systems. High intensity training is not going to get this done. You know, speed endurance is not going to get this done. And so the skill set to improve that sprinting speed is something that on day one, somebody should be thinking about, because even if you're not going to be Usain Bolt, that's fine. It's actually going to benefit some of the qualities that are important in endurance as well, such as, you know, your running economy, which has an oxygen uptake component and it has a muscle tendon unit component, right? And so that's one piece. It's also going to benefit when you have to surge in a race, because think about when you have to change gears. What has to happen? You have to apply more force. You have to change your running gait. And you have to do it in a way that it's not like disastrous for the rest of your race, because it costs so much to do it, right? And so again, if we've never built that skill, we're then going to try and put fatigue on top of that and then like try and reproduce that. We're really limiting ourselves. And so for everyone from day one, I'd be thinking about, yeah, let's build an awareness of understanding of, you know, what a tempo threshold run would be, right? So we know where we're moving from our steady state into our non-steady state. Let's really nail that skill, right? Let's also really nail what is sprinting, right? How can we improve our technique? How can we remove those limiting factors? And then as we build our training volume over years, we're putting it on top of a good foundation. Mm-hmm. And then we can really be more comfortable of going, hey, we really gave this person a shot of maximizing what they had. Unfortunately, many people don't get that exposure.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if I had an advantage. A lot of runners come from playing football and soccer. Mm-hmm. And you played football as a youth athlete, right?
Oh, very recreationally, but yes. Yeah, growing up in England, that was, yeah.
Right on. Yeah. You kind of had to. But yeah, I did my share of sprinting when I played soccer. And,
yeah.
And you know, I didn't entirely suck at that when I got into distance running. Getting into a little bit into your biography, there's a quote from my favorite philosopher, Friedrich Nietzsche, who he said, there are no philosophies, there are only philosophers. And his point was, like, the way we tend to approach science or, you know, trying to understand the truth of things is you can understand someone's intellectual approach to seeking truth from their life story, you know, like what they've experienced and how their mind works. And so I'm sure that insofar as that's accurate, that's probably the case for you. So what were some of the experiences that you had academically and athletically when you were coming up that sort of shaped your approach to, you know, seeking truth as a sports physiologist?
Yeah, I would say that the first sort of really profound experience I had was about 13 years ago working at Chelsea Football Club in the EPL. And at the time, the club had just come off winning a couple of championships. And even though that was the case, they were at the time the team to beat in the league. I remember my boss had a saying of, you know, high performance sport is about the relentless pursuit of being better at everything every day, right? So whether that's your administrative processes, or it's how you do something, or how you communicate something, or how you present something. And so that was a starting kind of real light bulb for me of like, oh yeah, this is really about pushing the envelope every day. Then I went back to Loughborough University and I did some sprints coaching. And it was actually a strength conditioning internship. And the coach at the time said to me, hey, Gareth, before you start doing some coaching in the gym, I want you actually to coach one of the sprinters, because I need you to understand the full perspective that a coach has and all the different considerations they have to make before you step into the discipline, right? And that was invaluable. And then learning physiology, as I mentioned at the beginning, started working with cyclists and triathletes and marathon runners. And so right there, you can see there's the spectrum of there's the sprint side, there's the endurance side, and there's the team sport physiology of thinking about that breath all the time. And honestly, like the physiology across team sports and all these things are more similar than people care to imagine. Like it's honestly very similar. And so I think that set a real framework for being able to look at the problems, let's say, of training and these things from a speed to endurance continuum, as opposed to like here's a model.
Well, you were working with all these different teams and athletes that played various sports, and especially working with the coaches too alongside them. We have our own coaching certification, and I'm just curious, what were some of the like personality traits or best practices that you saw from the coaches that you would deem really successful?
Yeah, one of the questions, Hannah, I actually went on the road wanting to understand was, were there any differences that tended to show up between those coaches that maybe delivered success one time with one athlete versus those who were able to do that on a repeated basis with multiple athletes over time? And there are a couple of things that really stood out. The first one would be that those who did it consistently were really operating in an environment that was high support, but also high challenge. Whereas maybe those who did it once, there wasn't necessarily the level of challenge, and often the environment became comfortable. So maybe the one time that it happened, the stars aligned and everything came together, and that was great, but the ability to reproduce that and evolve. The challenge piece links to a second piece. Like if I'm just challenging, right, and I'm not supportive, then you don't want me in your environment, right? But if I'm challenged and supportive and we're pursuing a goal together, then actually every day is about the act of getting better. And a big part of the challenge that I was common amongst those coaches were they were very curious as individuals, and they had, you know, one or two people that they used as advisors to test ideas off. And they were doing it from a lens of making sure those people had different backgrounds and perspectives. And that's like the role I play in our training environment here in Victoria, is our coaches lead the show, and then I try and be on the ground as much as I can with them to help provide a science lens on the conversation. And then together, the sum of our parts leads to a more refined decision about which direction we go, right? But a lot of people are operating as islands, and that's really difficult. It's really difficult over a long period of time. And in the middle distance, like the 800 is really where I specialize. That'd be the 200 in swimming, Hannah, I think. You know, it is like you're dealing with spinning so many plates, everything from speed through endurance, and all the athletes present differently, right? And I look to that and go, like, that's not a fair expectation for us to have on coaches, that, hey, we're going to put these expectations on delivering results, and you're holding all this stuff in your head on your own. It's like, what are our expectations in the, like, decision and delivery of stuff, that one person's going to master that on their own? And so that's the space I offer to our coaches, is, hey, let's work through these ideas together, because actually you're going to see things I don't, and I'm going to maybe see things that you don't. And together, the sum of that is better for getting more ships going in the right direction more consistently. And I think that's an under-talked about element, I think, of getting the best outcomes. Because the last thing we want is to stick to a plan and stand there 10 weeks later and go, hey, well, that's not really working. It's like, I want to know that straight away. I want to know that straight away. Mm-hmm. And the process we talked through at the beginning is almost, if you imagine like a sieve, you know, like sifting out what actually we should or shouldn't do with this person. Mm-hmm. That's a process for almost like refining the type of solutions I might think about for this athlete versus this athlete. And then that frames part of the coaching discussion we're having in the middle of a session. You know, how often have you stood there and gone, okay, well, today we're going to do five of these, and after two, so-and-so is really struggling. What do we want to do about that?
Yeah.
And to me, the answer you might come to could be 180 degrees different if you're more speed-based or more endurance-based, or based on what's coming tomorrow, and so on and so on.
Yeah. That's really fascinating. You sort of present a challenge to coaches. I mean, you're very fair to coaches, and you know the difficulty of the situation they often find themselves in. But if you look at that, you know, that threshold, that demarcation between good and great coaches, between coaches who succeed occasionally with athletes and coaches who succeed consistently, I think definitely one factor is laziness. If you're a little bit intellectually lazy, you're going to lean toward like a system, like this is my system. And you understand that there's individuality, but you're maybe going to give that lip service. And if you're a little bit less intellectually lazy, you are going to take that more individualized experimental approach. It's more work, right? But, you know, if you really want to be great, you got to do that. And I think maybe what you offer to coaches is like, you know, you're always going to have some coaches that are lazier than others, but if all coaches are able to learn from a Gareth Sanford, then we'll have more coaches who are individualizing. Even some of the lazier ones will have the tools to individualize if you have the influence you could have.
Yeah, let's tilt that, right? So I agree with you that it's more challenging, right? It's more challenging to start with an ongoing questioning basis and not have the answer of what we're going to do in 3 weeks on a Thursday, right, at 4 o'clock. I understand that. But who can relate to this scenario, right? You've got, let's say, three training groups going on in three different locations. You've got eight stopwatches, and you spend all your time writing programs because you've got 50 athletes. Like, who can relate to that? Who's seen that? Like, in college, you see that all the time, right?
Yep.
So I've met with a lot of coaches where they're like, I can't get individual. I've got too many athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But what if you could write three programs instead of 50? Because within your squad of 50, you've got a spread. You've done your 10-minute test. You have an idea of what people respond to. You've got your spread. You can then go, hey, I'm going to write a speed-based plan that sits more in this direction and an endurance plan that sits somewhere more here and a hybrid plan that sits somewhere in the middle. And then on the day, as you would be doing anyway, you can make those adjustments for the individual. Mm-hmm. And so what appears as this is really hard, this is really different, actually means writing three plans and actually giving yourself permission to explore the curiosity on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, I had all these other questions that I'm not going to get a chance to ask, but I wanted to go maybe a little bit further in because, I mean, there's a lot of value in this concept of individualizing training and, you know, like learning the athlete and letting the process unfold in an adaptive way. I was hoping you could maybe drill a little deeper in that direction. In my experience, there's a distinction between what I call walking around fitness, which is like what you're able to do untrained, and trainability. And in my experience, unless I'm kidding myself, I see athletes who like maybe are naturally gifted with endurance, but actually aren't all that trainable with endurance. Their endurance doesn't increase all that much. And I've seen, you know, very, very fast athletes who don't get much faster when you expose them. So there's like things like there's what you present in an untrained state, but then there's like, there's how much you can adapt to different stimuli. And then there's also tolerance. So I've seen athletes who are very responsive, but they still can't tolerate a lot of it. So there's a little bit more nuance to it, isn't there, than just like, you know, running a test on day one and saying, all right, that's the bucket you're in and you're going to stay in that bucket.
Oh, for sure. Let's go down this road. So if you, you know, put one of those athletes that you have in your mind in front of us and you go, okay, what's telling you that they can't tolerate it?
Yeah. So you want me to answer that question?
Yeah. Let's go down this road. Yeah.
So myself as an example, I had, you know, over a, you know, a long career as a runner and triathlete, I had maybe three instances when I overreached. You know, I sort of became stale and had a very poor performance in an A race. And in all three instances, it was when I was doing an amount of sort of like VO2 max interval training that would have been pretty typical for the category of runner I was in. Twice can be a coincidence. Three times is a pattern. And I felt like, you know what? I just can't tolerate a ton of VO2 max work relative to someone else who's doing like similar volume maybe. And so I'm very slow on the uptake, but eventually I decide I'm going to back off that a little bit. I'm not just going to train less, but I'm not going to lean as much into that type of stimulus. And it seemed to work out pretty well for me. So that would be an example.
Yeah. So I think what you're describing, again, to me, sounds like a couple of things. So the first one would be that often, again, with our bias of education of we want the answer, right, is that that can create uniform expectations of what people can handle, right? And that like VO2 max should be applied to everyone, VO2 max training, and it should be applied in the same amount and everyone's going to respond the same, right? So these are all like baked in assumptions that we're throwing around left and right with training. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is what the profiling can do is when we dig deeper into, well, what underpins an endurance type person? What do we know about endurance type people? So typically more slow twitch fiber in nature, which means their muscle machinery and their preference of physiology is set up to maximize the aerobic system. Okay. So when we think of VO2 max training stimulus, VO2 max is, yes, got a big aerobic component, but it's also got a large anaerobic component. And you're not in steady state physiology. So we're actually operating in a place that's a little bit uncomfortable for what our body is set up to do, where typically the more longer slow distance, the more moderate intensity, critical speed or tempo type running, we can get into that a little bit if you like, is actually the thing that fuels what you have, right? Because you're going in, you're locking in steady state for long periods, and you're really flooding the system that you're built to optimize. You know, there's some good work showing that actually in slow twitch muscle, the number of close capillary contacts, so the train lines that deliver oxygen to the muscle, has a very tight, almost one-for-one relationship with your critical speed or critical power. You know, and so with that in mind, we have to look at that and go, okay, we've profiled someone. they're a more endurance type person, hey, maybe we should really be going down this route and leaning into that stimulus. Whereas some of these others that have a bit more of a larger anaerobic glycolytic type component, like your speed endurance or your high intensity training, we maybe want to sprinkle that a bit more than necessarily having long sustained blocks of doing that. Because the key question we should be asking is, given what we know about the individual, how are they getting to their best performance? And this is an example, Matt, of, hey, if we knew who you were up front, then maybe we'd have had a different conversation about, hey, Matt, VO2 max, that works for some people. How is it being deployed for everyone? Does that suit who you are? Mm-hmm. And if everyone's doing 6 to 8 weeks of it, do you need 6 to 8 weeks of it? Or do you need one or two or two or three? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But let's not dig ourselves a hole, because we know the other stuff actually is the thing that makes you good. And actually the other side of this is that when you're working on low and moderate intensity work, what you're starting to do is build, I think of aerobic training like a bank account, right? So when you're doing low and moderate intensity, you're putting money in the bank. Every time you do some VO2 max work, or you go and race, or you go and travel, or you do these things, you make withdrawals, right? So people go to high intensity, like you're talking about, and they hit it for a long period of time, and they go, well, that was good for 3 weeks. But 6 weeks later, they go, I feel tired, I feel fatigued, I now don't feel as fit, because actually I've started to detrain my bank account and I've not kept an eye on that as I moved into the intensity. So that's one piece. The other piece is the fatigue you get from the VO2 max stuff actually makes it hard to make inroads on the sprinting speed and the technical adjustments, because you're always tired, right?
Yeah.
And so if you're focused on low and moderate intensity, that's a perfect time to also be working on that top end 3 to 6 second speed. And that alone, before anyone's done any high intensity training, will improve your tolerance to deal with surges, to handle those elements. So I think in a nutshell, that's how I think about the puzzle of putting those pieces together.
Yeah, I would have a much better marathon PB if I had understood all of this when I was 31.
But now's the chance, right? Now's the chance for like the people that are going through your system. Yeah. And that's the opportunity here for people. That's the opportunity.
Yes, exactly.
You know, like it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's exciting. Like you can really just sort of accelerate that learning curve.
Yeah.
Cause you're just, I mean, every good coach experiments and they know you got to, your concepts are giving us a head start and allow us to make the process more efficient, you know?
Yeah. I mean, to people listening, you know, how many people have you seen or observed or even coached yourself where you've gone weeks or months or sometimes even years of going, hey, I'm not sure this is working, or we can't figure this situation out? You can fast track your understanding of all of that from a 10-minute process, asking those 6 questions, tell me about 3 sessions you like, 3 sessions you don't, and let's move from there. Now, a question that people might ask is, okay, well, what does that mean in terms of training and what goes in a training week? Well, we revisit the speed to endurance continuum, right? We have our sprinting speed. Like there are, maybe if I zoom out, I would say the world is drowning in training zones at the moment, right? And terminology. So I'm going to make it real simple for everyone. I really think about 3 items and that's it. 3 items is the scaffolding for everything else. The sprinting speed, the speed at VO2 max or power at VO2 max, and then the critical speed or power, which for anyone listening is that second inflection on a lactate curve. Again, it's a bit of a terminology soup. At a high level, we're really just talking about understanding where's the tipping point from when you move into non-steady state physiology, where breathing, where perception, where lactate all rises, okay? I want to know where those 3 are. And that's what I'm looking at every week of a training program. The easy stuff needs to be easy. If we're talking about a marathon or something even more enduring in the ultra space, then yes, maybe we want more resolution on that kind of LT1 first threshold. Absolutely. But generally speaking, most people who are just starting out do not need to be concerned with the nuance of that, because that's not where you are. You just need more volume. You just need to train, right? And you need to work on those areas. Then we can start looking at, once you've ticked that first box, you can then start looking at how you build out the specificity of the event. But the thing with endurance is, ultimately, a lot of it is limited by your physiological capacity. So we need to have that right. We need to have that right. And so people getting lost in zone two, which depends on which, you know, which model you're talking about, right? So really focus on those things. Can you sprint? What's your 6 minutes speed power for VO2 when you decide to put those high intensity blocks in? Not all the time. And then your kind of tempo runish pace at critical speed, and then easy stuff around that. And that's just scaffolding for your week. You know, and the VO2 stuff is kind of in and out as you want either a change of stimulus or threshold becomes a really high percentage of that VO2 pace and you want to raise the ceiling again. So that's what most people need to do, and just do that consistently, right? And have a weight room program in place that supports you structurally in being able to handle more volume as you get to the point where it's appropriate to increase that. If you can't do those things consistently, unfortunately, the endurance game is tough. That's just what needs to happen. Because, you know, when you get to, you know, there's some really good work coming out in like pro cycling and triathlon, looking at this concept of durability, which your listeners are probably familiar with. But ultimately, what the evidence is starting to show is that, hey, we can all have a power profile or a speed profile fresh, but what differentiates those who get on the podium at U23s and at senior pro levels is those who can reproduce that after expending 2,000 calories, right? At the back end of a 2-hour triathlon or at the end of a cycling stage race. And so how do we build that durability? Well, there's a fueling piece, but honestly, there's also a training piece, and you have to have those physiological capacities to come back and do that. And so, again, if we're starting at the beginning, there's a ticket to the dance in terms of that durability, right? Let's say in triathlon, on the men's side, to be in the top 10 in the Olympics, you probably need an MAP of around 490 watts. We cannot like that. We might not agree with that, but that's the ticket to the dance to be in that arena. So we can play all day at being enduring and durable. But if we don't have the maximal peak power to even be in the arena there, we can be as enduring as we like. It's not going to matter. It's really not going to. And that's just that's the uncomfortable world of the sharp end, right? But that's why from day one, having that 3-second peak power, working on that actually for the long term, really enables you to hit your goals there. I mean, even Kipchoge, right? Trying to run sub 250 for 2 hours, like that's not just endurance.
Yep.
Yeah.
Love it. Well, lots of good info from you today. You definitely dumbed it down a little bit for people like myself, so I appreciate that too.
Much appreciated.
So just one final question to wrap it up. You deal with a lot of athletes reaching their peak potential, and they are the best in the world. And so my question for you is, what does your peak potential look like, and how are you going to get there?
Well, honestly, I think more of this, right? Because the topics we've discussed today are challenges in almost any coaching environment. I'm sure the listeners are thinking about their own situation. These are decisions people are making every day, and it's challenging, right? And so it's important, like from my perspective, like the science is great, but we have to be able to connect that, you know, and make it real. And like, okay, how does that help us based on what we're going to do in our session tomorrow. So I think really helping in that translation piece and creating the confidence for people to feel like, yeah, we can go and do this now. So that's, that's a space I'm kind of transitioning into a lot more. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Nice. Well, we'll keep you for as long as we can around our space so you can continue to do that. Well, thank you so much, Gareth. We would love to have you on again. And yeah, again, just thanks for dumbing it down for me and have a good rest of your day.
So I'm just going to touch on that before we finish. Okay. So I make this point seriously, is that, you know, sometimes coaches or people who aren't scientists can feel like or can put scientists on a pedestal or whatever, like we're just people, right? And coaches are just people. And actually it's on scientists to be able to translate in a way that people understand, you know, to help work together in moving the needle forward. So just want to set that straight on the dynamic, because like, hey, honestly, we're all just trying to figure it out and doing our best.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it, because I was a little intimidated coming into this conversation because of, you know, you Google your name and it's all of these publications and things. And I mean, your Twitter is definitely easy to read and understand. But yeah, I was a little intimidated. So it's nice to hear that from you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're all trying to get it done. Hey, so. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much again.
Yeah, it's been great talking with you. Yeah, you
thanks,
bet.
Gareth.
We sincerely hope you enjoyed today's episode with Gareth. At the heart of his coaching philosophy is education. He's all about making the complexities of training and competition accessible to anyone. So if you have questions for him, his information will be in the show notes and feel free to reach out. And speaking of education and show notes, I will also link the 80/20 coaching certification so you all can check that out. Perfect for athletes and coaches who want to level up their knowledge in the endurance sports space. Wrapping us up with the What Is Your Jam segment, mine for the week is Out of My League by Lainey, L-A-N-Y, all caps. It's a fun, easygoing, windows down, I have a crush on someone song. So if you're looking to be in a little bit of a cheeky mood and want a pop song, this is for you. Be sure to share this episode with anyone who you think would benefit from it. And please rate us and review wherever you're listening to this podcast. We'll talk to you guys next week. Bye.